Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hello, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's another regularly scheduled weekly episode. And you know what that means? It means we have selected a game to talk about.
Yes.
We are going to pick one game. We're going to talk about how to play it. We're going to talk about some strategies that you can use to win at it. And then we're going to talk a little bit about its design. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Five Tribes, designed by Bruno Cathala. So that's another Bruno Cathala game in, you know, 2 weeks in a row. And published in 2014 by Days of Wonder.
All right. Now, for a short description, and this time short is used a little loosely. This is kind of a long one for this part. But for a short description of what this game is about, in Five Tribes, players attempt to gain control of the Sultanate of Nikala by currying favor with the five local tribes and the mystical djinns. The board is set up as a 5x6 grid, with each space of the grid being dealt three meeples of five possible colors. On a player's turn, they pick up all of the meeples on one space and drop them one by one in a trail of spaces. When the last meeple is dropped, it and all other meeples of the same color are removed from that space and a number of actions occur. First of all, the color of the meeple determines the first action taken. Then the action described on the space itself where you stopped happens. Finally, if the last meeple was removed from that space or any other spaces other than the first one, the active player places a camel on the now empty space, which secures points for the end of the game. Other actions determined by meeple color and spaces can include gaining money, acquiring djinns, purchasing items from a trade row, or building structures on spaces for bonus points. Play order every turn is determined by an auction, and because your money is equal to your points, it's important to spend wisely. Once one player places all of their camels on the board, or no legal moves exist on the board, points are totaled, and the player with the most points wins. So that is the short description of what Five Tribes is about.
Yeah.
And the biggest part of this game is the main mechanic of how you take your turn.
Yes.
So I say let's start describing that a little better.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you're familiar with Mancala, then this mechanic will make a lot of sense. But if you're not, then we'll have to get into a little bit more specific detail of how this mechanic works.
Yeah. So let's see where to start, I guess. So
the board has a bunch of meeples on it.
Yeah. And the board is separated into a 5x5 grid of tiles.
5x6.
30 tiles. 5x6. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yes. I miscounted. Yeah. So at the start of the game, each tile will have three meeples of different colors, and on your turn, you pick up all the meeples and you use them to move to another tile. By move, I mean you drop one meeple at a time on tiles you want to go past, outward from the one you started on, and the final tile you end on, you have to leave a meeple of the same color as there already is one.
So this essentially what you're doing is for every meeple on the space that you pick up, you are you're going that many spaces away from where you started and ending there by placing your last meeple there to take the actions.
Yeah. One specific thing is that you cannot reverse direction doing this, but you can loop back around if you have enough meeples.
Mm-hmm.
And I say have enough because eventually more meeples will get placed on some squares.
Right,
because
so
you're leaving
at
behind
the
meeple
game,
everywhere you move.
Right. So at the start of the game, every space has three meeples on it. You'll pick up three meeples from a space, leaving it empty. And then you'll drop one meeple on three spaces. So the first two spaces, you'll add a meeple. They'll have four meeples on them. And then the third space, you'll drop your third meeple, but then you remove meeples to take the actions.
Right.
So how that works is, like we said, there's five possible colors that these meeples can be. At the start of the game, they're dealt randomly. Sometimes a space might have two meeples of the same color and a third meeple of a different color. They're rarely, but sometimes it could have three meeples of the same color, which is usually a very good thing for whoever gets to go first that turn. But when you pick up your meeples, you have to look at those spaces that are three spaces away at the beginning of the game, and then X spaces away later on when you're picking up different amounts of meeples. But you're looking at those spaces three spaces away, and you're looking for a space that has at least one other meeple that matches a color of one of the meeples you have picked up. Because you need to end there with the meeple of that color. So, like, for example, if you pick up a space that has a blue, a red, and a yellow meeple, and you see three spaces away there's a space with some red meeples on it, then you drop the blue meeple on one space, the yellow meeple on the next space, and then the red meeple on the final space, and then you have been able to successfully activate the red meeple ability. And when that happens, you pick up all the red meeples from that space and take that action.
Right. You want to go over the meeple actions real quick?
Yeah.
And kind of expand into what they do?
Sure.
Okay, so the yellow meeples are when you use their action, you take them and place them in front of you, and they'll give you one victory point per meeple at the end of the game. And then if you have the most yellow meeples at the end of the game, you'll get another 10 victory points. The white meeples are worth 2 victory points per, and no other bonus points, but they will have another function that we'll get to a bit later when we talk about the tiles.
Mm-hmm.
The blue meeples, they give you points depending on the space you landed. Every space on the board has a number of victory points associated with it for when you capture it. Mm-hmm. And these numbers can be blue or red. And the blue meeples score bonus points by multiplying the number of blue meeples you picked up times the number of blue tiles in the 9 spaces around and including the one you just stopped on.
Mm-hmm.
The red meeples allow you to assassinate one meeple on another tile, and the distance away is how many red meeples you picked up. So if you pick up 2 red meeples, you can assassinate a meeple up to 2 tiles away, which means you put it into the bag of meeples and remove it from the board.
Essentially, there's this bag of meeples that acts as a meeple discard for when meeples have been spent. From the board.
The blue, red, and green meeples all go into this bag when you use them. And the green meeple, which is the last one, allows you to take that many cards from the market row.
Right. So every turn, or round, I guess, there is a market of 9 cards that gets refreshed. And they are grouped in groups of 3. And from right to left, there's like the first group of 3, the second group of 3, the third group of 3. And for the green meeples, you acquire the first X cards. If you pick up 3 meeples, then you get the first 3 cards from the right. And that would shift the remaining 6 cards over. So now there's a new 3 cards in the first, you know, group of 3, and then 3 in the group of 6, or the group of 3 after. Anyways, so those are all of the meeple actions. And on your turn, you'll just be figuring out which one of those you want to attempt to activate. And in order to do that, you just need to look and see where you can find a pile of meeples on one space that can be laid along in a trail so that it ends on another space that has the color of meeple that you want, that you match with.
Right. I want to talk really quick about the market, because that will kind of transition to the next part better.
Okay.
So the market itself has, I don't know how many, I think 9 different suits of cards. And these are like goods that you've acquired through trading with the merchants, which are the green meeples. Mm-hmm. And the number of each good in the deck is shown on the cards by a number of diamonds. So some of the rarer ones, like I think just gems, there's only 2 of. Or some of the more common ones, like fish, there's like 8 of in the deck. And this is important because at any point during the game or at the end of the game, you can trade in a group of unique goods to gain points/money.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount you get is based on the size of the group you're selling.
Yeah, you could kind of think of it as like a straight.
Yeah.
Like as a poker hand, as opposed to pairs. You don't want pairs for these cards. You want to get a straight. You want to get a bunch of different cards.
Right, yeah. Trying to find the actual rate.
Mhm. Yeah, it starts out small. Like, I think if you just have 1 unique card, you get 1 coin, and then it goes up from there. Eventually, once you get to like 6 or 7 unique cards, each you're getting essentially 10 points per card or something like that.
I think it goes
something
up
to that effect.
I think it goes up like 1, 3, 6, 10. I just looked it up and it goes 1 for 1, 3 for 2, 7 for 3, 13 for 4, and then 21, 30, 40, 50, 60. So by the time you reach the sixth one or the seventh one, it's 10 per card you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
And it goes up to 9.
Yeah. And okay. So the big thing about this, though, is there's also one other type of card you can get in the shop, which is the Fakirs. And these are cards that will help you do all your other meeple abilities. So the blue and red meeples, you can spend Fakir to increase the sort of multiplier that they have. So for blue meeples, it's not only do you count the number of blue meeples you have to multiply, but you can also spend Fakir to add to that number. So blue meeples plus Fakir times blue squares. For red meeples, you can add Fakir to increase the distance you can assassinate. And then let's get into the spaces, because this is where the djinn come into play.
Mm-hmm. So there are, is it five different actions that a space can offer you?
Yes.
In this game? Okay, so the first action is you can spend gold to buy a single card from the first grouping of three in the market.
Yeah, it's three gold for one out of the first three.
Gotcha. And then the there's another action that's like a slightly beefier version of that, which is you can spend six gold in order to acquire two cards from the first six in the market.
Yeah.
There is an action that lets you place a palace on the space that you landed on. And palaces are worth 5 points at the end of the game, 5 bonus points for to whoever person, controls yeah. the space with the palace on it.
There's also placing trees on the space that you landed on. Mm-hmm. And trees are worth 3 points for whoever controls that space at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the lamp. So when you land on a space with the djinn lamp, it has you spend a white meeple plus either a white meeple or a fakir. And when you spend white meeples, you take them from your supply and put them in the bag. And then you can get one of the three djinn that are face up in the group of djinn. And just like the market, these refresh at the start of every round. And the djinn all give you victory points, first of all. But they also all have some pretty powerful effects that some of them will be like bonus actions you can take. Some of them will be like modifications to your other actions. Some of them will just be like bonus points or
right, like for example, you get. One of the djinn that I received in the game we played was it allowed me to spend a white meeple or a fakir at the end of my turn to build a palace anywhere I wanted.
Right.
There was another djinn that I had that increased the amount of points that white meeples were worth at the end of the game for me by 2. So instead of being worth 2 points each at the end of the game, they were worth 4.
Right. There was one I had that made it so when I assassinate meeples that aren't red, I get extra bonuses based on what color it was. There's one that gives you money whenever somebody builds a palace, including you. So yeah,
there's like one that gives you money whenever someone drops a meeple on a space you control with a camel.
Yeah.
So yeah, all of these abilities just kind of add value to the other actions of the game, or they give you these bonus actions that usually occur at a better rate than if you were to do it like as a part of your turn.
Exactly.
Or they just usually just add value to the things you can do.
Right. And yeah, they're usually worth more points than the white meeples that it takes to buy them as well.
Right. It depends. I think the lowest a djinn can be worth is 4 points, which is the same, which is equal to the amount of white meeples. If you can at least use one white meeple and one fakir, then it's always worth it.
Yeah.
But if you're only using white meeples, yeah, you'll break even on a djinn that gives you 4 points by itself. But they can go up to like 8 points, I think. It's like from 4 to 8, something like that. Four to six or 4 to 8. And then the spaces themselves, like we mentioned, they earn you points. I think the lowest that a space can offer you by having your camel on it is 6 points. And it goes up to 15 points, I believe, is the highest.
Yeah, I think there's only 115.
Yeah, they're around 6 to 8 points each. But yeah, they can get up there.
Yeah.
And that's only if you have a camel on those spaces. And again, you place a camel on a space by removing all of the meeples from that space on your turn.
Right. It should be noted that this does include assassinating the last meeple on a space.
Yes. And with that note, I think that's a good
transition. There's one more thing, which is auctioning the turn order.
Right. Okay.
So at the start of the game, I believe the turn order is set in stone. But then after the first turn...
No, at the auction order is random on the first turn.
It's random on the first turn. Okay. So yeah. There are a number of spaces. The cheapest space you can auction is 0, and then it goes like 1, I think it's 1, 3, 5, 7, 8, 9. Oh, okay. I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, it's 1, 3, 5, 8, and then
13.
I want to say 13.
No, 1, 3, 5, 8, 12, 18.
Okay.
I just looked it up.
Nice.
Sorry. But there is one thing, which is that there are 3 0 spaces, and if you bid 0 and then somebody else bids 0, they slide your auction token down a space.
Right. So essentially, they outbid later. You.
Yeah. Zero they can outbid existing zeros.
Another 0. Yeah, but there's only 3 of those. So if you're playing a 4-player game, somebody has to bid at least 1.
Yeah.
Now that we're getting into strategy, sometimes it's better to bid 3. Now in this game, money is worth points. It's like it uses the same symbol. So at the end of the game, whatever money you have left over, each dollar is a point. You start the game with 50 coins, I believe. And there's ways to earn coins over the course of the game in addition to securing points. But usually you'll end the game with less money than you started with. And that's because every turn you have to make these auctions, and then there's other times when you spend money, like when you're buying cards from the market. So the auction on each turn, you really only want to be spending money on the auction if there is a critical move that you see for yourself.
Yeah.
And when I say critical move, I would say that any move that can earn you like 8 points on average is a critical move.
Yeah.
And earning 8 points is the important factor, because taking a critical move will oftentimes mean making a high bid for the turn order, because you need to take that move before somebody else can, or before somebody else can mess it up by dropping meeples, you know, on the space that you intended to pick up from and changing the number of spaces away that you can go to take your move. So that means bidding high, and because points are dollars, that means that every dollar you spend is subtracting from the points that you're earning from your critical move.
Right.
So when everything balances out, you're going to want to hope that you come out like 8 points richer on average.
Yeah,
that's a good move.
You can think of it as the points you're getting minus the money you're spending on that position.
Right.
And you want that total to be like 8 points.
Yeah, I think on average that's the rule of thumb that you're looking for.
Right.
So what kinds of critical moves are there?
Well, first off, obviously you want to take meeples that are in large groups, and more often than not, the only time during a game there will be like only a meeple of a single color on a space is if it's the very start of the game. So look for those, but I think general, like, placing camels is always good, because mm-hmm. it secures a pretty good amount of points, especially if it's, you know, one of the higher ones, like for 15, or if it's, like, one with a palace or a palm tree,
mm-hmm.
because then you can just keep raking in points from that location.
Plus, the game ends once somebody places all of their camels. Right. So if you just place all of your camels very quickly and end the game very quickly, you'll likely be the person with the most points.
Exactly, yeah. Other things are getting large groups of green meeples, and because those can help you really get like a large set of cards really quickly.
Right.
Large groups of white meeples.
I think when we played, I focused highly on getting that set of like 7 or 8 unique cards to get all those points at the end of the game. And I ended up in second place, just like 3 points behind the person in first place. And I had probably the fewest camels on the board too.
Mm-hmm.
So it is worth it to focus on the market and getting those unique cards in your hand. And yeah, so in order to do that, getting a lot of green meeples is a critical move.
Yeah.
I put down like, if you can get 3 unique cards in a turn, then that's a good play.
Yeah. And then getting white meeples, especially if there's 2 white meeples or more on a space that lets you get a djinn.
Mm-hmm.
Because like we said, djinn, oftentimes they'll give you more points than the white meeples would be worth. But also they do give you bonus actions, and generally having options and access to that can help push you over the edge. Like, yeah, like when we played, our mom won because she had the djinn that gives you money whenever people build palaces. And so every time anybody built a palace, she would get 2 coins, which is 2 points,
mm-hmm.
Which made up more than the palace was giving, like, you. And so, yeah, looking for those djinn and being aware of them is really useful. Other than that, I mean, like, setting up assassinations is good. One trick that we noticed is if there's an empty space, you can move over it, leaving 1 meeple, and then end your turn on a spot with a red meeple so you can assassinate, and then assassinate the 1 meeple you place down on the empty space to mm-hmm. control it.
Right. You just kind of go backwards down your trail to a spot where you left a meeple on what was previously an empty space. And by assassinating it, like we mentioned, that will allow you to put your camel down there.
Yeah.
If you can get really lucky, then you can do that on a turn where you are removing all of the meeples on the space that you land on with the red meeples. So, like, if there's a single red meeple on a space and that's nearby an empty space, then you can, you know, drop your meeples on a trail going up to that red meeple, leaving 1 of them on that empty space. You'll take all of the red meeples off the space, leaving it clear, letting you put a camel down, and then assassinate the meeple on the trail that you left, leaving that space clear, putting another camel down.
Yeah.
That's a very valuable turn, especially if either of those spaces that you ended on or that you cleared are worth more than 6 points.
Like the
cheapest spaces are often worth.
I think as far as like where you want to put camels, one of the most crucial ones is the palace spaces,
mm-hmm.
because you can have more than 1 palace on a space, just however many times it's landed on. So like you can, you know, land on it the turn you clear the meeples, get the palace and the camel, and that's a big point swing, because mm-hmm. oftentimes they'll be like 13 points alone. And then you can set up a later turn to land on it again just by dropping meeples around it. And then you just get 5 more points that way, along with whatever meeple action you got.
Mm-hmm.
Which does bring me to a point about auctioning that I wanted to mention.
Okay.
Which is that if you're the last person on a turn, you can set up the next turn and then bid really high, so that you get essentially 2 turns in a row.
Normally, right, because if you're last to go on a turn, that means that you are also going to be last to auction on the next turn, which essentially guarantees that you can go first. You just have to pay whatever the next highest available bid is.
Yeah. But like getting 2 turns in a row is a huge boon, because if there's 2 different colors of meeples on a space, normally you can't clear it out. Because if you take 1, then the next person's going to take the other color and finish it. But 2 turns in a row lets you get both of those and clear the space. Or, like, leave 1 meeple down without assassinating, but then pick it up on the next turn to mm-hmm. claim the space and get the bonus for the meeple you put down. So, right. Yeah, looking for those windows where you can get two turns is huge because of that.
But, of course, like, everybody else might see what you're trying to set up and bid high and force you to bid a little bit higher than you're comfortable with. So just always be weighing the cost versus benefit of what you're getting for a turn. And if you do that setup, but then, like, the other three players or however many players that get to bid before you see it and they start bidding high, you know, if they bid too high, then it's not really worth that many points to them.
Right.
And if they don't bid high enough, then it might still be worth it for you.
Right. Sort of the trade-off is that if you make it less than, like, 16 points, then they might bid under that 16, but also taking that action wouldn't be as valuable to them. So, I don't think there's a good, like, rule of thumb for when you should do either way, but, you know, generally...
I think the best opportunity to do that is when you have a djinn that makes whatever turn you're trying to set up uniquely beneficial to you.
Oh, yeah.
So if it's like you're setting up a turn to where you can pick up like four white meeples and you have the djinn that makes your white meeples worth double the points, that's a really good turn to set up for yourself. And that's a turn that probably nobody else is really going to try to take advantage of.
Yeah.
I just have a point to say that you want to be very careful about where you're leaving your meeples on your trail. Like, for example, you don't want to stack up a big stack of yellow meeples or white meeples or green meeples. Like, say there's a space that starts the game with two green meeples and a red meeple on it, and you pick up a pile of meeples and start making your way across the board. You don't want to drop another green meeple on that space for somebody else to take advantage of on your turn. And then also the even bigger thing to never do is on those spaces with that are worth like 15 points or, you know, those high point value spaces, never leave a single meeple there.
Yeah.
So if that space gets cleared because somebody takes a pile of meeples there to take their turn, and then it comes to your turn and you pick up a pile of meeples and start making your way across the board, you do not want to pass over that space.
Yeah,
because if there's a single meeple there, then it is the easiest thing in the world to pick up that meeple and secure those 15 points.
Yes. It's very huge point swing there that you're giving to your neighbor or whoever's next.
The last thing that I want to say, I guess, is that it's not a bad thing to go later in the turn order in this game. It's not everything to go first, just because, like, at the start of the game, it's pretty uncommon that somebody can put a camel on their first turn, on the very first turn of the game. That's like the only way that could happen is if three meeples of the same color get put on a space,
or two red and one other color,
right? Or two red and one other color. So if that happens, you know, the first player is going to get a lot of value out of it. Nobody else is. If that doesn't, then the only way to have like a valuable turn is to wait till the board has changed and developed a little more. And you know, people are dropping meeples on spaces so that there's more of them. And, so anyways, going later in the turn is a good thing, at least early on in this game, because the board can change into more favorable positions.
Yeah. Like if you're looking at the board before auctioning, you might not see any way to get camels, but it's likely that by the time it comes to the final person, there will be room to get one camel on the board for them.
Right.
Just because, you know, meeples are cleared out, things are moved around, etc.
I guess I could also say, like, just be aware of your opponent's strategies. And sometimes you'll have to counter draft them. Like if you notice somebody's going for a lot of market cards and you see some pretty rare cards, you know, even if you're not sure whether or not they have them in their hand, you can just try and snag those away from them.
Yeah.
And then same thing for like djinn. If you see that they've like set up a strategy and there's a djinn available that can like really make their strategy pay off, then you can try and snipe that djinn away from them.
Right. Yeah.
And usually in both of those cases, it's you're not getting nothing out of that. You're still getting the points for the djinn, or you know, you're setting yourself up with some rare market cards that will make getting a big set easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's about all we have for the strategy. So let's talk a little bit about design.
All right.
Where do we start?
The biggest thing to note about this game is its usage of the Mancala mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
So Mancala, of course, being an old, ancient, abstract strategy game, where you pick up, like, beads or stones, and you place them one by one going around a track. And it's been forever since I actually played a game of Mancala. But the idea of you're picking up pieces that each have a individual score and using them to move, as well as like the number you pick up being how you move, but then placing them so that other turns have more things, that mm-hmm. whole thing.
Right. It's a game where you move around a board, but you don't roll dice or anything. The number of moves is determined by the number of these pieces.
Yeah, it's like a deterministic movement, but in such a way that it's impossible to predict that far ahead, because mm-hmm. like there's so many numbers being changed so slightly. And with Five Tribes, it's not just a loop. You're moving around a grid that you can go in any direction.
Right.
So like, how do you make that easy for players to actually figure out what to do? You know, how do you combat analysis paralysis? And so one big thing is the fact that the game can kind of be summed up in two types of actions, like we did the colored meeples and the spaces, already mm-hmm. mean that a player doesn't have to focus on movement so much as they focus on their desired end point or their end action and then work backwards.
Right. Like we said, for an example, there was a you might want to look for a space that has a lot of white meeples where you can purchase a gin. So right. It's got a lamp and white meeples.
So,
and so in that case, you just look for that space and you can find it. And then from that space, you just work backwards to another space that has a white meeple on it that you can pick up.
Right. And like this does, like, there's still, you know, factors going into this decision, like where you're dropping the meeples you're using to move, but those add more to the skill ceiling than it does to the initial decision. But having like those quick rules of thumbs and heuristics can really help player comprehension. Also, mm-hmm. just the fact that large groups of the same color are always good means that there's like a visual thing that players can easily track. Like the eye just kind of focuses on those spots naturally.
Mm-hmm. Right. So because the multiplicative nature of these the effects that come from the meeples, like blue is the number of meeples times, you know, this, and green is the number of meeples is the number of cards you get. That's, you know, mechanically there's a reason to go for large quantities. And visually it's very easy to spot those.
Right. Normally, you know, it'll look like this huge thing of confetti, like a Jackson Pollock painting. But when mm-hmm. you find this large splotch of color on one square, that usually is a good thing. And the fact that it's all one striking color, like all the colors of meeples are pretty saturated and they mm-hmm. contrast really well. So it uses color to help.
The three primary colors plus green and white.
Yeah. So the four primary colors and white.
Green is not a primary color.
Okay. Never mind. I was making a joke.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Also, the fact that empty tiles are important, or almost empty tiles, means that the large empty spaces are also very useful for creating this visual heuristic. So, like, in reality, it doesn't become as much about, like, you know, 30 times however many spaces, actions. It's more like there's a few different actions, so like five endpoints and five colored meeples, and you find the best version of those, and from there on you go.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not too hard.
It also helps that, like, some of the goals that you're shooting for are separate from the board, you know, in these distinct spaces. So, like, one of those goals is the market, where you're looking at the groupings of three and you're seeing, like, if I get X green pieces, I can get this many cards on the market. Or you're looking at the gins that are also set aside and you're saying, like, I want that gin. You know, there's also some separation there. To help you identify, like, which of those goals that you want to attempt for that turn.
Yeah. You know, something I literally just remembered that we didn't mention in the rules overview is that the red meeples, the assassins, you can instead remove another player's white or yellow meeple from their supply and put it into the bag. And this is important because everything in the game has counterplay. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's buying a card or a djinn before somebody else, or removing their colored meeples, or like setting up turns so it's harder for other people to claim spaces.
Mm-hmm. Just by adding a meeple to a space, you know, as you pass over it, you can totally change the options that that space had. Like, if that space had that one perfect move, if you just add a meeple to it, now that perfect move is impossible.
Yeah. And a lot of this, like, especially the meeple movement counterplay, is incidental to making yourself better. Like, the things that help you incidentally hinder the opponent in some way, oftentimes.
Yeah.
Which is always nice that, like, you don't have to take huge steps and sacrifice huge gains in order to counterplay. I think a lot of playgroups have a hard time with, like, taking down kings, so to speak, or monarchs, for a non-gendered term. You know, so, like, when somebody's really high in the lead, not everybody wants to cooperate to take them down, especially because it reduces their own point gains or whatever. But this game does a good job at making that incidental. And also, so the fact that the auction uses money, which is also points, so it uses points to auction, like, that gives any action a counterplay of, do I want to spend points that I've already gained in order to prevent that from happening for somebody else?
Mm-hmm. We talked before about the self-balancing qualities that an auction affords a game.
On that note, I do want to talk a bit about terminology in the game.
Okay.
This is something I don't think we touch on a whole lot, but, like, the word choices for mechanics and things can make a big deal when it comes to player comprehension. In this case, something I like is that in a lot of games, it can be hard to remember that money equals points when that is a thing. Like, in Small World, I often forget that, like, I'm spending points when I bid on a higher race class combo.
Mm-hmm.
In this game, though, anytime you gain money, it is referred to as scoring. So, like, the blue meeples say score points equal to, you know, this, the blue spaces times the number of blue meeples, which what it means is that while you are spending the money like money, it constantly reminds you that it is score nonetheless. It hammers it into your head, like, you are spending points.
Mm-hmm.
Which helps make you much more conscious during the game so that you don't end up making huge sacrifices accidentally, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one important point that we should have made with the rules is that on the last turn of the game, everyone still has to pay the amount of money that they auctioned, even if they don't get to take a turn, like, because the last legal move was taken.
Yeah.
That's why I lost our game, was because I bid too high on the final turn.
Yeah.
And I came up short.
I have
a point of design that I'd like to talk about.
Okay.
And that is the idea of tips and tricks. Because not a lot of games have something like this. But this game has a bunch. And I kind of want to just kind of think about why this game has them. So, like, tips and tricks, it's kind of something that I'm picking up from, like, video games, where there's, like, setups, or there's, like, little pieces, little techs, as they call them in video games, that can give you, like, these incremental bonuses, or that can, like, you can just use this little trick and it always ends up with a good, like, result for you.
Yes.
So in this game, the example of that is, like, how the red pieces work. Where you can leave a piece along the trail, then finish on a red piece, and then assassinate that meeple that you left on the trail and get that point, like, every time. Like, the game doesn't necessarily tell you how to do that. It doesn't have any illustrations, at least. It does say, like, if you assassinate the last piece on a space, you get to gain control of it. But it doesn't say, like, by the way, that's really easy to do on the turn that you assassinate, you know, by just making that space yourself. And then there's a couple other similar things in this game, where, like, for example, you can use greed meeples to end on a space where you buy cards from the market, because you can use the greed meeples to shift the cards down into different brackets so that you can then purchase them, like, if they are previously out of reach. And the same thing is for, like, white meeples on a space where you can acquire gin, because you will always be able to afford the gin once you go there.
Right.
So how does this game get those in it?
So this is something, I think I've heard it called systemic design. It's a big deal in video games, especially roguelike / roguelite video games, where you design the game in terms of, like, systems or, like, different branches of the game, but you make sure that every system can interact with every other system. So in this case, it's that the meeples on the board interact with, the cards, or, like, the market is based on both the board and the green meeples, but in slightly different ways that can affect each other. Or, the red meeples can interact with the camel placement in this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like every piece has multiple functions, but it's not just like they do. It's not that you have an option of doing things. It's that, like, their consequences are explored further.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just like red meeples can destroy a meeple. It's what if you destroy the meeple that's on a space? And the Bruno Cathala must have thought, like, okay, maybe that adds a camel. So, like, rewarding people for exploring all the consequences of a given action. You know, everything it can do.
Okay.
At least that's what it seems to me.
I thought another reason why it happens in this game is just also because each, you know, action in this game is very similar. It's kind of like there's a lot of repetition in this game. Yeah. And when you have a lot of repetition, then you have a lot of chances to, like, examine what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like if every turn I'm picking up pieces and dropping down and then seeing what happened, you know, eventually there's going to be a turn either by accident or because I devised it where I do something and then something better happens. And then I can see what I just did and I can try and recreate that success again and again and again. And it doesn't take long before you've kind of gotten the ideal situation down. Like you start to recognize when those situations are coming up.
Yeah.
Because you're so familiar with them because they happen so often for you.
Yeah. It's sort of like in Tetris, you get better at learning how to set up certain things as you play, just because you recognize the shapes that you need to do a given structure.
Mm-hmm.
The more you do that simple task, the more you get turns to, you know, focus on the sort of hints and signals that you can do it, or the just you get to experiment more. I think also that when you want to keep a game relatively mechanics light, such as in this case, you know, since the Mancala movement can be pretty complicated on a turn by turn basis, all the mechanics do something kind of similar, but there's only like a few actions you can take per, you know, type of action. When you want to do something like that, you want to make sure they interlock as much as possible just to gain like a lot of mileage out of each mechanic. You know, it does a lot with a little in this case. At least to me it seems like that.
So yeah, I'd say those are all pretty good points on sort of how you accomplish that sensation. I think that's a really cool sensation to experience in a board game.
Yeah.
It's like in chess when you memorize like sacrifices or forks and stuff like that. You start to see them coming up. That it's kind of a level of mastery,
mm-hmm.
To have these tips and tricks. But it's a level of mastery that's for a player very easy to reach because it is a tip or a trick. It's something that's like very easy to teach. And in this game, it's also easy to discover.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's about it then.
Yep. Was that a shorter episode this time?
Kind of.
That's all right, because next week we are very excited for the game that we're going to review, and we think we're going to have a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
Should we just say what we're playing next week?
Teaser.
We like to do little teasers on Twitter, but I think this one's just exciting enough that we'll just say it. But we got a copy of Stonemaier Games' new board game Tapestry, and we've already played it once, and I really enjoyed it personally.
We made a big rules mistake that completely shifted what I was doing the entire time.
We don't need to tell our listeners that, but the next time we play it, we'll do better. And it's kind we're of gonna a play
story.
It. We're gonna play it a bunch, and we're gonna talk about that game next week. Yes. So look forward to that. But in the meantime, that will be the end of our episode, and we really appreciate that you've listened to it.
Yep. Thank you for listening.
If you like, you can find us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can hit us up with comments and suggestions there for topics that you think you'd like us to talk about. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find all our episodes that we have tagged. So if you're looking for an episode of a specific board game, you can go through the tags, find the board game there. That'll take you straight to the episode. And if you don't see what you're looking for, then hit us up on social media. On our website, you can find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast, where we have merch with our cool logo on it. And that will do it for Board Game Bros plugs. So let's hear something from Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream most weekdays from about 1 a.m. Central Time to maybe 3 p.m. Central Time. I've been experimenting with the times I actually stream at recently. But if you want to get updates on when I go live, you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, or you can also go onto that stream page and then find a Discord server where you can talk to other fans of our work, as well as get updates on when I go live and talk to us as well. And I also write articles on the Board Game Bros website under the Episodes and Articles tab. I think my most recent one is still about a manga that I read that I wanted to review and talked a bit about genre in that. I'm still working hard on the next one to come. But till then, go check out what I have. I have some stuff on game design, especially including roguelite design. So yeah.
All right. That does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.